These are African rhythms, passed down to us through ancient spirits. Feel the spirit, a unifying force. Come on, move with the spirit. Stand up, clap your hands. Move with the rhythms, get down.
From WSNC 90.5 FM, a broadcasting service and NPR affiliate of Winston-Salem State University, welcome to Africa World Now Project. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. Today, a replay of the recent historic press conference with the Cuban permanent representative to the UN, His Excellency Ambassador Pedro Luis Pedroso Cuesta. Africa World Now Project is next. On June 23, 2021, a total of 184 countries voted in favor of a resolution to demand the end of the U.S. blockade on Cuba for the 29th year in a row, with the United States and Israel being the only countries voting against the resolution. Three countries, Colombia, Ukraine, and Brazil, abstained. Wednesday, July 7th of last week, the world received news of the assassination of the then Haitian president in the midst of already tense conditions on the ground. On this same day, a historic press conference with the Cuban permanent representative to the UN, His Excellency Ambassador Pedro Luis Pedroso Cuesta, presented a review and response of the recent vote against the blockade, as well as the challenges and promises of the recent development of the Cuban COVID-19 vaccines. On Saturday, July 10th, reports via mainstream media outlets began proliferating images and a narrative that suggested the Cuban people were protesting against the ineffectiveness of the government. However, more detailed and clear journalism shows that this was not the case, as the mass majority of the protesters were clear in their disdain for the embargo, which in turn has caused deleterious impact on the population. According to the UN Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, the economic sanctions on Cuba were imposed by the United States of America in 1960 and were subsequently amended by the Cuban Democracy Act of 1992 and the Helms-Burton Act of 1996. These acts essentially banned all commercial ties between the United States and Cuba and severely impaired the right of U.S. citizens to travel, to communicate with, or carry out cultural exchanges with Cuba. Every year since 1992, the General Assembly has passed a resolution calling for an end to the embargo. The most recent resolution on this issue, A/67/4, was adopted on November 13, 2012, by 88 votes against 3, with 2 abstentions. Since the United States is the major regional economic power and the main source of new medicines and technologies, Cuba is subject to deprivations that impinge on its citizens' human rights. Moreover, the U.S. makes its own foreign trade policy extraterritorial through a system of secondary sanctions which force third-party countries into imposing an embargo on Cuba. For your benefit, and in accordance with this central mission of Africa World Now Project, which is to provide a platform that allows you to intentionally organize information toward understanding the root causes of issues that impact historically and ethnically marginalized peoples, paying specific attention to the Africana world, today we will play the recording of the historical press conference, organized in part by yours truly having nominal input under the leadership of Obi Ekpuna Jr. and a collection of other concerned communities and organizations. Next, you will hear the Cuban permanent representative to the UN, His Excellency Ambassador Pedro Luis Pedroso Cuesta, present a review and response of the recent vote against the blockade, as well as the challenges and promises of the recent development of the Cuban COVID vaccines. Our show is produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Enjoy the program. Summerland, murder never grand, truth is death's edge, spirits of the land, restless.
Good morning, all. My name is Gail Walker, and I want to welcome all members of the media, as well as members of the community, to this press conference to address the recent vote at the UN, the United Nations General Assembly, in opposition to the US government's embargo of Cuba and Cuba's successful COVID-19 vaccine campaign. I will open up the conference with a brief statement. We will then hear from Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell, the former General Secretary of the National Council of Churches. Reverend Campbell will introduce Ambassador Pedro Pedrosa Cuesta, Cuba's permanent representative to the United Nations. The ambassador will then take questions. Given the time constraints, questions have already been received. However, further questions can be submitted in the chat for consideration. The question and answer session will be facilitated by Mr. Bill Martinez of Martinez Arts Consulting and Ms. Marguerite Horberg, founder and executive director of Hot House. And finally, there will be a closing remarks by Mr. Obi Egbuna of the Get Out of Cuba's Way campaign and the Zimbabwe-Cuba Friendship Association. So let us begin. Again, my name is Gail Walker, and I am the executive director of IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, and co-chair of the National Network on Cuba. In both capacities, I have worked to support improved relations between the US and Cuba and for an end to the harmful blockade, the harmful sanctions imposed against the Cuban people. Furthermore, as a faith-based organization committed to social justice, IFCO applauds the results of the recent June 23rd UN vote, where the overwhelming majority of the world's nations voted in favor of a resolution to demand the end to the US economic blockade on Cuba, as it has for the past 28 consecutive years. We're deeply saddened that the Biden administration failed to join the rest of the world in voting yes. Yet it is another indication of the US government's isolation in its policy of blockading Cuba. The US government's longstanding sanctions have had a tremendous effect upon Cuba and its people. And this is the case in many sectors, but particularly devastating in the medical area. I was in Cuba a few weeks ago and witnessed firsthand the current medical crisis. Our multiple bags stuffed with medical supplies barely made a dent in terms of the need. It was heartbreaking to speak to a surgeon who had to tell his patients he couldn't perform surgery due to the lack of antibiotics and painkillers. However, it is important to note that Cuba has the ability, the technical know-how, to produce the medicines the country requires, but is unable to do so due to the lack of raw materials needed to manufacture many of the basic medicines it needs, including antibiotics and pain relievers. Under US law, any company that uses 10% of US-derived materials is not permitted to trade with Cuba. This holds true whether the company is a US company or not, and it's just one example of the extraterritorial nature of the US policy toward Cuba and why it's called a blockade instead of a unilateral embargo. Nonetheless, still, Cuba has managed to produce 5 vaccine candidates to fight COVID-19. Cuba reports that one of the vaccines, Abdallah, has a 92.28% efficacy rate, placing it in the top 5 of currently recognized vaccines worldwide. Ironically, while Cuba has managed to produce effective treatments for COVID, the small island nation has a shortage of syringes to help get shots in the arms of the Cuban population. And that's why the Syringes for Cuba campaign, organized by the Global Health Partners here in the US and supported by the National Network on Cuba's Saving Lives campaign, has raised $400,000 to purchase 4 million syringes and is currently working to raise another $100,000 to purchase an additional 2 million syringes. And these are in addition to the syringes sent from others in the international community. If relieved of the crippling US sanctions, Cuba would be able to address its medical needs. In fact, over the past year alone, Cuba has sent 3,700 medical workers, healthcare workers, in 52 international medical brigades to 39 countries overwhelmed by the pandemic. Cuba's international medical brigades have treated patients and saved lives for the past 15 years in 53 countries confronting natural disasters and serious epidemics, such as the Ebola crisis in West Africa. Cuba has pledged to produce 100 million doses of its COVID-19 vaccine to meet its commitment to share its low-cost vaccines with poorer nations in the developing world. Another example of Cuba's medical internationalism is the medical school scholarships that the Caribbean island offers young people from various nations, including the United States. My organization, IFCO, is proud to facilitate this opportunity for U.S. students. Today, there are nearly 200 U.S. graduates of Cuba's Latin American School of Medicine, with nearly 60% practicing in underserved communities across the country. As Cuba struggles to confront its current medical crisis, her friends in the international community, and particularly those of us in the U.S., the very country that has maintained the punishing sanctions for more than six decades, educators, social workers, labor activists, clergy, and more, those of us who make up the vast Cuba Solidarity Network will continue to stand up and speak out against the unjust blockade and continue to work for normal relations.
My phone is, I'm down in my basement, and my phone is, oops, Gatling.
We'll continue to do this work for our to normal relations with our southern neighbor. So thank you. I thank you very much. Now we will hear from Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell, the former General Secretary of the National Council of Churches of Christ in the USA. In addition to being the first ordained woman to lead the NCC, Reverend Campbell has served as a devoted activist for peace and social justice. She has played a critical role in the fight for the return of Elian Gonzalez to Cuba in the year 2000, as well as the return of the Cuban Five. Reverend Dr. Joan Brown Campbell, the floor is yours.
Thank you so much. I was listening very carefully to what you said, and am so pleased to think that we are still fighting and we are still working as hard as we can to bring to reality the relationship between Cuba and the United States. One of the things that I know from my time in Cuba is that Cuba has many gifts to give us. And it is our problem when we don't go away and don't take time to understand what the gifts they have, their abilities to deal with people who are not well. I know that myself. I became very sick at one time when I was there, and it was nothing until a few minutes until I was taken care of and became quite well again. I'll never forget that. But it's not one person. It's what happens in the United States. And I'm very concerned now that we are not bringing to the fore, and I'm thrilled that we're here today, that we can be saying once again, Cuba is here and we are here to be with them and to walk with this and to walk with people there so that we can become reconnected in a strength that is failing at some times because of what the United States is unwilling to let people come here to Cuba in the way that they did. I'm very glad for what we're here doing here today. And hopefully that when we leave, you can tell that I'm getting older. What I really think is we need to be together in ways like this, and we need to be working with Cuba because this is something that we have been doing for years. And I think there's much yet to be done and things for us to give our lives to.
Thank you so much, Dr. Campbell. And I believe is now your opportunity to introduce our special guest, Ambassador Pedroso Cuesta.
Yes, indeed. It is my honor to introduce one that is known to many of you that will come to speak to us in just a few minutes, standing here. The representative of Cuba to the yes, here we come, all so that we can be together and we will be able to meet with him in just a moment.
His Excellency.
His Excellency, we are looking forward to seeing you and to hearing you speak.
Ambassador Pedro.
Ambassador
Pedro Cuesta.
Yes. Ambassador, we welcome you, Ambassador Pedro.
Thank you very much, Joanne. I really appreciate it, and good morning to all. Thank you, Gail, also for your introductory statement. First of all, allow me to thank you deeply, National Network in Cuba and IFCO Pastor for Peace for organizing this event. Also, thank you very much to all the members of the media for the interest and all of the participants in this exchange. As you all know and has been stressed, last June 23rd, by the 29 occasions, the United Nations General Assembly voted in overwhelmingly in favor of the resolution necessity of ending the economic, commercial, and financial blockade imposed by the government of the United States of America against Cuba. Only two countries, the United States and Israel, choose to vote against this resolution. In 60 cases, a lot has been told about this cruel, criminal, and genocidal policy. The voices against the blockade are every day more and more, even inside the US. You are a testimony to that. I would like to thank you all for gathering this morning here with me for this exchange. As a representative of a courageous people that fight, continue to fight and stand in front of two viruses, and I would say two killer viruses, the COVID-19 and the blockade imposed by the US. In the last 4 years, the government of the United States added 243 economic coercive measures against Cuba, which remains in effect today. These measures are not mere actions to tighten the bargain, but new methods, some of them unprecedented, that have escalated the economic war against Cuba to extreme levels, with widespread impact in the daily life of our people and in the Cuban economy. Those 243 unilateral coercive measures were intended to restrict travel by US citizens to our country and damage tourist markets in third countries. The Trump administration adopted those measures, which are proper, some of them, to times of war, like the one adopted with the purpose of depriving Cuba from fuel supplies. They persecuted the health services that Cuba provide in numerous countries abroad. It increasingly harassed our country's commercial and financial transactions in other markets and set out to spread fear among foreign investors and commercial entities through the implementation of Title III of the Hans-Burton Act. It also hindered the regular and institutional flow of remittances to families. They dealt a harsh blow to self-employed and private workers and hampered the links with Cubans residing in the United States, as well as family reunification. All these measures remain in force today and are being fully implemented. Paradoxically, they are shaping up the behavior of the current US administration of President Biden, particularly through the months when Cuba has experienced the highest COVID-19 infection rate, the highest number of fatalities, and much worse economic impact. Just in the past weeks, the US Department of State included Cuba in the unilateral list of trafficking in persons and of countries which are allegedly not cooperating fully with the US efforts in fighting terrorism. All those unilateral and arbitrary listing without any base, authority, or international support are only intended to defame and pressure countries refusing to bend to the will of the US and governments that stand on their own sovereign decisions. Cuba is not a state that sponsors international terrorism. All the country has been a country that has suffered from terrorism promoted, organized, and financed from the US territory. No one can claim that Cuba is a state sponsor of terrorism. Cuba has an impeccable history, an impeccable fight of fighting international terrorism. Cuba disdainfully deplored every maneuver aimed at manipulating such a sensitive issue to achieve gross politically opportunistic goals. Going back to the embargo, for Cuba, the restrictions adopted during the last 4 years magnified the many challenges imposed by the COVID-19 pandemic and multiplied its devastating socioeconomic, health-related, and financial impacts. Between April and December 2020, less than a year, just amid the pandemic, the blockade made Cuba to incur in losses estimated in the order of $3,586 billion. Added to the losses of the previous year, the total from April 2019 to December 2020 amounts to more than $9,157 billion. The accumulated damage of the blockade imposed to Cuba during 6 decades of economic embargo amounts to over $147,853 billion. It is important to understand that if Cuba would not have to suffer that policy, and if Cuba would not have been deprived of those resources, the country could go a long way towards bringing much of its infrastructure up to date and could, for example, change the national energy matrix to renewable sources in less than 5 years. That amount, if it was available, could considerably assist in enhancing the living standard of our people and would turn the country's financial situation around, boosting the confidence of foreign investors and creditors, and subsequently increasing the access of the country to financial markets. Under the present conditions, the embargo represents a huge burden for the Cuban population and economy, with particularly devastating effects owing to the COVID-19 pandemic. Cuba has been forced to allocate considerable resources to urgently secure necessary equipment and materials for its national health system. The impact of the embargo on the health sector, one of the hardest hit during the reporting period, may be seen in the shortages of essential consumer products, as well as the difficulties national industries face in acquiring the necessary supply for inter alia food preservation and drug manufacturing. The negative impact of the extraterritorial component of the blockade could also be seen in the Cuban health sector. For instance, the cases of the German companies Sartorius and Merck stands out, as well as those of Positiva and other regular suppliers of laboratory materials, reagents, and general supplies. Due to the intensification of the blockade, they stopped trading with Cuba in 2020. During this period, Cuba was unable to obtain a total of 32 pieces of equipment and supplies related to the production of vaccine candidates against COVID-19 are needed to carry on the necessary stages for the completion of the clinical trials of these candidates, including equipment for the purification of the components, accessories for the production equipment, filtration tanks and capsules, potassium chloride solution, thimerosal, and reagents. As a result, Cuba had to resort to other providers and intermediaries, which led to price increases of 50 to 65% above normal established prices. Despite all these enormous obstacles and limitations, the work done by Cuba to tackle the pandemic has been recognized internationally. The country has five vaccine candidates that have been mentioned in development and has sent 57 medical brigades to support the fight against the pandemic in 40 countries and territories. The immoral smear campaign led by the government of the United States against Cuba International Health Cooperation has not been able to curb the intimidation of our professional staff. I thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Cuesta. This was a complete summary for all of us. You may have covered a lot of the topics that we're going to be talking about in this question and answer period. And I know that your time is limited, so we're going to cut straight to the questions. Marguerite and I are going to ask most of the questions that were submitted to us, but in some cases we will paraphrase the questions or combine them since some of the questions overlap from the different sources. We'll start out with the messages from Charlene Mohammed, the host of Liberated Sisters on KPFK Radio, and Nisa Islam Mohammed, who is the editor for the Final Call Press Corps. Their first question is, in his first major address, I should say, the Honorable Minister Luis Farrakhan talked about the end of the bloqueo, the blockade against the country, so we can access treatments. Can you tell us your thoughts about that and how Americans might be able to get access to the vaccine?
Thank you very much, Bill, and thank you very much to Charlene for the question. I think the statement is quite relevant. As I said before, a lot of have been said about embargo and the blockade policy has been gaining the fight against the blockade have been gaining even more supporters, even included here in the U.S. and particularly also in internationally. We are seeing, for example, the caravans that have been put in place the last Sunday of every month. All of them have been growing each time, bringing more people interested against this fight and in solidarity with the Cuban people. So we are of the view that all these fight, all these actions against the blockade, the sending the resolutions that many of you are sponsoring in the different states and actions to the presidency of the United States, to the White House, letters to congressmen, all that is extremely useful and valuable. And in relation to the question of how people here in the U.S. can have access to the vaccine once they are in place, Cuba has always been open to provide and share whatever achievement the country has been able to make with all the countries around the world. And of course, the U.S. is not less. I would like to remember this.
Is-
You are currently listening to a recording of a historic press conference held July 7, 2021, where the Cuban permanent representative to the UN, His Excellency Ambassador Pedro Luis Pedroso Cuesta, is presenting a review and response of the recent vote against the blockade, as well as the challenges and promises of the recent development of the Cuban COVID vaccines. Our show was produced today in solidarity with the Native, Indigenous, African, and Afro-descendant communities at Standing Rock, Venezuela, Corporation Jackson in Jackson, Mississippi, Brazil, the Avalon Village in Detroit, Colombia, Kenya, Palestine, South Africa, Ghana, Haiti, and other places who are fighting for the protection of our land for the benefit of all people. Continue to enjoy the program.
To remember at this specific occasion the offer made by Cuba to the U.S. when Katrina affected this country. Actually, the Henry Reef contingent was specifically formed to help and assist in the fight against the consequences of Katrina that you all know was not accepted by the government of the time. So Cuba will be open to share with all countries, including with the U.S., its outcome in terms of the development of these vaccine candidates as in other areas of scientific research.
And so are you seeing the level of movement to end the bloqueo at it's sort of an open-ended question, but are we optimistic that somehow we're in si se puede, that we shall succeed in ending the bloqueo at some point? That's we've all wanted that, but that's one of Charlene's questions. Are we near the end of the bloqueo or no?
We are convinced, Bill, sooner than later, the bloqueo would have to stop. It would have to stop because it's an illegal policy, is an immoral policy, is rejected by the international community, and is also rejected clearly by the most of the population in the United States, including most of the Cubans who live in the United States, who wants to have a normal relationship with their relative in Cuba and have the liberty to freely visit their families in Cuba. This is an untenable policy. It's unsustainable politically, economically, morally, and ethically.
Thank you. And we're going to move to the questions by Elliot Booker, Time for Awakening Media. His first question was, which of the G7 countries made requests to trade with Cuba before and after the UN vote? Did you have a lot of the G7 countries already in sync with you doing trade with Cuba?
Well, the only G7 country with whom Cuba doesn't have a normal relationship is actually with the U.S. With the rest of the G7 member countries, Cuba has a normal relationship, including economic relationship, which is also very much damage because of the extraterritorial impact of the blockade. And as you know, the blockade is not only something that affects directly the bilateral links between Cuba and the U.S., but something that has a very profound consequences also for third countries and third countries' companies who want to engage in a normal economic trade or financial relationship with Cuba.
And what are we with the COVID-19? How many of the various vaccines are in phase 3 of the trials? Where are we at with the various vaccines?
Bill, this is, I would like to first to refer that the fact that Cuba has been able to produce 5 vaccine candidates is very well built on the investment effort that the country has done for years. I would like to remember it was Fidel in 19, in 1960, when the creation of the Cuban National Scientific Research Center, who said that the future of Cuba would have to be a future of men and women of sciences. And that in itself enclosed the meaning of what we have been able to achieve, not only now, but in recent years. I would like to remind, for example, the strike made by Cuba when we developed the anti-meningococcal vaccine, the strides made in developing different cancer vaccines and other pharmaceuticals by the Cuban pharmaceutical industry. So this new development is very closely related, not only to that investment in infrastructure, but also to the investment in human resource development. And, you know, since the beginning of the pandemic, we said that we, as a blockaded country, actually, we didn't have any other option than to try to put the best of our science and our scientific resources to try and to go and develop projects to try to come up with our own vaccine candidates to fight the pandemic. And of course, this envisage a lot of efforts, a lot of commitment by the all the scientists, a lot of cooperation. It was not a task of one single institution. It has been the outcome and the result of the very close cooperation among the many scientific institutions in the biotech industry in the country.
And Cuba has reached out to the other South American Caribbean countries as well. They've been generous in going out to, of course, everyone knows about the Brigadistas going out to help so many others around the world. But in particular for the vaccine, have they reached out to I assume that they've been reaching out as well to the other countries of the Caribbean and South America, correct?
Yeah, we have been clear since the beginning, as I said before as well. I mean, the results that Cuba will be achieving at this will be clearly shared with countries in Latin America as well as other countries in the world. But a number of countries, I can say, that have approached already Cuba, very much interested in the outcomes. And with some of them, we have already signed agreements for when the vaccines are in production phase, and when they have been approved by the Cuban regulatory agency and are in the market, and trials are being conducted also in some other countries like Venezuela, Iran, some Caribbean countries has also approached, and some of the southern nations in Latin America as well have shown as Mexico have shown interest in having access when those vaccines are in the production phase.
Thank you. Elliot had one last question. It was about, you know, years ago, the Congressional Black Caucus signed a memorandum of understanding to try to get, encourage youth, especially people of color, kids of young youth of color to get educated there and to become doctors through the wonderful program that Cuba offers to develop young doctors to go back to their communities and serve them. Elliot's question is, it seems like there's not that much force going on, not that much encouragement going on by the Congressional Black Caucus at this time. So how do we stimulate that? How do we make sure that the unrepresented communities are getting their medical staff trained there, and that if the Congressional Black Caucus isn't following through to push that, how do we push that so that we make sure next generations of doctors are coming our way to serve the communities through Cuba's educational program?
Thank you, Bill. I think this is a very relevant question, and I can say Cuba has kept its commitment to facilitate the scholarships for underrepresented community people, students in the U.S. to have access to health studies in Cuba. And we're also very grateful, I have to acknowledge here the commitment and the permanent fight of IFCO Pastor for Peace in keeping also this program. Actually, as Gail mentioned at the opening, around 200 graduates already have produced this program, and we will be very happy to see more Jews from the U.S. Coming to take advantage of this, and we are very, we are also open to continue working not only with IFCO on this, but also with other initiatives on this. We think that is important. One of the ways I think it can be, you know, made more visible the contribution of this student is to bring more to the public of what they are doing now. For example, they have been inserted in different medical institutions all around the U.S. I think it would be, you know, it would help to make more visible what each of them is doing in every in all those places where they are, to bring them together and to talk to different communities, to talk to their representative, to in their state assemblies or their representative in Congress and some. Those are, in my view, very useful ways to raise awareness and on the importance of this program.
Correct. Okay. Wilmer Leon, the author of Politics, Another Perspective, who's also the host of Inside the Issues on Sirius XM Satellite Radio, Channel 126, he asked, he first has a sort of a general statement. U.S. Secretary of State Blinken and President Biden talk about protecting or enforcing rules-based order instead of protecting and enforcing international law. In light of the recent vote of the U.N. on the bloqueo, how hypocritical is it for the U.S. to blockade or sanction countries that are not in violation of international law? That's part one. And part two of the question is, let's talk about the anti-imperialist coalitions that are being formed, whether it's Venezuela, Cuba, Iran, China. How are the anti-imperialist coalitions relating to each other to provide for health and well-being? Those were the two questions of Wilmer and Leon.
Bill, I mean, you said it. I mean, this is a very hypocritical policy. It's untenable. Simply, the U.S. government cannot sustain its policy towards Cuba, and we have demonstrated that we are able to sit down together and to fix all our differences, and of course we know that we cannot solve all of them. We are different and we have to respect each other even with our own differences, and respecting each other's respective sovereignty, equality, which is a principle of international law and of the charter. And of course, not only the case of Cuba, but also so many other people and countries in the UN are realizing this hypocritical approach of the U.S. Government when looking at some relevant international and very sticky issues of international importance. Not only with Cuba, for example, the issue of Venezuela or the policy in relation to other countries, of course, and the awareness that I referred before, all this solidarity coalitions and grouping the caravans, the love, the bridge, love, building bridge of love initiative are also quite important to counteract these other hypocritical rhetoric and coming back to the international arena and coming back to multilateralism. It's very clear that if you argue that you're coming back to multilateralism and you argue that you are committed to principles of multilateral resolve of dispute, the issue of Cuba puts that to the test. And that is very much clear.
Great, thank you. I'm gonna turn the questioning over to Marguerite right now. Marguerite Horberg from Hot House, take it away.
Thank you so much for inviting me. It's really a very stimulating and educational conversation we're having. And repeating what Bill said earlier, a number of the questions we received sort of cover similar ground around the vaccines and policy and the post June 23rd. So if I don't read the entire question, please feel free to write in the chat that your question wasn't adequately answered. So I'm the first question I'm representing is from the All African People's Revolutionary Party in New Mexico. And it's from Oniyesonwu Chatoyor, who's a Hood communist and weekly Pan-African News and AAPRP program from New Mexico. And it's another policy question. And the question is asking about the allegations around human trafficking. The question says, recently Anthony Blinken accused the world-respected and renowned Cuban medical team of engaging in human trafficking during the 2021 Trafficking in Persons Report launch ceremony. How do you think this outlandish charge is related to the U.S. recent blockade resolution vote? And what do you think a statement like this signals about the intentions of the Biden administration toward Cuba?
Thank you very much, Marguerite, for the question. I think clearly this is a very hypocritical accusation. And as I said before, it shaped very much the conduct and the attitude of the current U.S. administration. Nobody can seriously argue that Cuba is a country that is engaged in trafficking in persons. Cuba has a very clear commitment to combat trafficking in person, and it's very unfortunate that the current administration decides to endorse in some way the accusation of the President Trump's administration, that everybody knows was with the purpose, the intended purpose to cut resources by Cuba. Everybody knows that the health cooperation, the international health cooperation that Cuba provides to a number of countries is sustained on bilateral arrangement and bilateral agreements signed with all those countries interested in the Cuban cooperation. All those professionals involved in that cooperation decide freely without any governmental pressure on their participation, and they sign contracts for engaging in this cooperation program. This is an slander and a smear campaign that we have denounced and we will continue to denounce. And it's only, trying and it's very, also in times of pandemic, it's also quite unfortunate that the U.S. engages in this political of trying to deprive people of health assistance in other countries that otherwise that they cannot have, because the work that Cuban professionals do in those countries cannot be easily supplemented by professionals, national professionals in those countries or any other foreign professional. So this is an unsustainable campaign Cuba has denounced and will continue to denounce, and we have a proven history even in of cooperative relationship with the UN mechanisms that work in the area of trafficking in person. The US cannot sustain those accusations against Cuba.
Thank you. There's sort of a second part of that question, which has to do with how Africans in the US, and I'm assuming other people of color who are faced with an onslaught of slander and propaganda, how can people join in solidarity to combat this kind of false narrative and be more effective in fighting this propaganda campaign?
Well, I would have to say, for example, many of the countries, and we had more than 50 statements, during the General Assembly session that examined the issue of the U.S. blockade on Cuba. And many of those statements at the General Assembly referred specifically to the appreciation and the value that those countries attach to the Cuban medical cooperation, and many of those stress the value that their people give to the cooperation and work by the Cuban medical professional in their countries. Also, during the high-level segment in the General Assembly, a very quite relevant number of the leaders who participated in the settlement in that high-level week segment also underline the importance and the appreciation of their governments for the solidarity that Cuba has put in place in cooperating in the health sector through the medical brigades with those countries. Many of those countries are from Africa, from the Caribbean, and also I would have to say many of these caravans, because the caravan movement has become, started here in the US, but now has become more an international movement. And every month in many cities around the world, included in many of the African cities, we have seen caravans of people against the blockade and calling for the lifting of this unjust policy. So we very much believe that our African sisters and brothers have also much to say and much to contribute to this international movement against embargo.
Thank you for that reply. I think that if people have links to how to get involved, they could put them in the chat. So the next question, I feel we've covered a little bit already, which has to do again with the vaccines, the distribution. Are there ways people can help with Cuba in the mission? The question was posed by the All African People's Revolutionary Party, Sobukwe Shakura and Shavanduka Savanhu. And since we've discussed it kind of at length, I think the question more narrowly focuses on, maybe you could speak perhaps about the syringe program, if that's a way people could help.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. We very much appreciate all the movement that has been put in place here in the US, but also in many other parts of the world, in of the world in trying to mobilize assistance to Cuba with the development of the vaccine program and the syringes problem program that was already mentioned by Gail in the opening statement. We attach a lot of importance and appreciation to that. And of course, that is one of the areas I said it because of the embargo, we are lacking a lot of spare parts and disposable materials and you know syringes are part of those disposable for putting in place the vaccine program, which has been also affected the scaling down of the production precisely because of the lack of some of the inputs needed for the production, not for the vaccine itself, but for the production in an industrial scale, because you need, of course, a number of items, a number of inputs to guarantee, you know, the production scale of the vaccine. And of course, the syringes are very much key to that effort. So I think, and we will continue to appreciate every effort that is done in trying to mobilize here in the U.S. and in other part of the world, syringes for Cuba.
I want to just kind of pick up a thread in the chat that sort of also referred to the question, which really tries to emphasize the relationship between Africans in the U.S. and Cuba. So if there's something more specific or pointed about how that particular relationship and solidarity can be strengthened.
Margaret, there is an inextricable link between Cuba and Africa. I mean, in the formation, in the building up of our nation.
Due to time constraint, you can listen to the entire program on Africa World Now Project's SoundCloud. Just search Africa World Now Project. That's it for Africa World Now Project for this week. I would like to thank you for joining us today and look forward to spending time with you next week. We can be reached through all your regular social media platforms. Email africaworldnowproject@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter @AFWRLDNWPRJ. Instagram @AfricaWorldNowProject. Access to our other media platforms can be reached through the bios of our social media. I'm your host and producer, James Pope. The Africa World Now Project Collective consists of international media journalist, executive producer, and human rights activist, Moise Muntali, Africa World Now Project media correspondent, Funa Ngonda, senior research content contributor and production director, Dr. Tasneem Siddiqui, senior research content contributor and production associate, Dr. Josh Myers, associate producer and content contributor, Dr. Keisha Khan Perry, content contributor and filmmaker, Kurt Waterson, technology advisor, it's Byron Gray of Grayworks Technologies, and creative directors, international creative and artist designer, Tabassum Siddiqui and Judah Pope. Africa World Now Project can be heard every Wednesday at 7 p.m. on WSNC, NPR affiliate and broadcast service of Winston-Salem State University. Programs are archived and available on all podcast platforms. Search Africa World Now Project. Until next week, be safe, be peaceful, and above all, be intelligent.